Okay then, brethren, we're now on part three of our sort of brief review of the book of Daniel. You know, a couple of years back, we spent a lot more time on it. So if you want to refresh your understanding in some detail, you could always go back and either listen to some of those messages, or of course, there are the notes my wife put together, which again can be potentially quite helpful. What we're doing at the moment is much more of a brief sort of a summary, and we'll see if that helps us all. So far, we've looked at Daniel chapter 1 through 9. We ended up in chapter 9. Daniel chapters 2 to 7, we could consider to be Aramaic Daniel in the sense of those particular chapters, the six of them, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. Those six chapters are not written in Hebrew. You know, most of the Bible is written, most of the Old Testament is written in Hebrew, the New Testament in Greek. But these chapters in Daniel are written in Aramaic. And we can speculate as to the reasons why, but, you know, a plausible reason is that the message contained in Daniel 2 to 7 was really for the whole world of that day. Because Aramaic was the language that nearly everybody at that time would speak. And of course, within Daniel 2 to 7, we saw rather impressive testimonies from King Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, one of the chapters in our Bible was written by King Nebuchadnezzar, right? And he wrote a testimony to the whole world of his day in Aramaic saying, "Worship the God of heaven." And then, of course, we had Darius came a bit later, and he was so impressed by Daniel that he wrote out a testimony in Aramaic to the whole world to honour and respect the God of Daniel. So all rather interesting. We also saw at the time that in these six chapters there appear to be almost three pairs, insofar as chapters 4 and 5 and 3 and 6 and 2 and 7 seem to rather parallel and amplify each other. You know, chapters 4 and 5, you have the story of one great king who finally humbles himself and honours God, Nebuchadnezzar, and one king who rejects all those lessons and loses his life and his kingdom, Belshazzar, who saw the writing on the wall. Then chapters 3 and 6 are a pair. In chapter 3, we have the saints, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, who refuse to worship Nebuchadnezzar's image and get thrown into a fiery pit. In Daniel 6, we get Daniel thrown into a pit of lions. So again, some parallels and echoes there. And probably of most interest to us is Daniel 2 and 7, because both of those chapters have parallels and echoes, and they cover prophecy right up to the time of Jesus' return. Daniel 2, the great statue with four metals, takes us from Daniel's day all through 2,500 years, right up to Jesus' return when he smashes the statue on its feet and his kingdom is established around the whole world. And then Daniel 7, four kingdoms leading up to the kingdom of God, although Daniel 7 appears to be entirely end time. Okay, and one other thing perhaps we could comment on is that the kingdoms mentioned in Daniel 2 and Daniel chapter 7, the four kingdoms or empires, today are all Islamic. They are Muslim. Babylon today is Iraq. It is a largely Islamic country. Persia, we call Iran today, but again, is Islamic. Greece, or actually in Hebrew, is typically Javan. Asia Minor, today represented largely by Turkey and some of its satellites. Turkey is, again, Islamic. And I've said before, the Fourth Empire is Islamic in any event. So I think that's possibly a bit of a clue to us that the Islamic realm and Islamic jihad are going to be key players in end time prophecy, because all the kingdoms in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, all of them are Islamic. Now, of course, most of us traditionally have grown up looking to Europe and Rome and the Vatican and Germany for the fulfillment of many of these prophecies. But in the past, we've covered why that doesn't really seem to stack up. So I'm not going there again. Daniel 8 seems to be next in line, as far as you and I are concerned, in terms of world fulfillment, because Daniel 8 talks about, you know, a sort of a ram running out, a he-goat counterattacking. That appears to be major war taking place in the Persian Gulf area, with economic chaos probably for much of the world. And then last time we ended in Daniel chapter 9. And Daniel chapter 9 contains the prophecy of the 70 weeks. The 70 weeks prophecy, 70 weeks being 70 times 7, which in prophecy we believe, most people accept, refers to a 490-year fulfillment until righteousness finally reigns. And in that 490 years, we seem to be left at the tail end of it with a 7-year period right at the very, very end time, actually still slightly ahead of us. And this appears to relate to a 7-year covenant or a 7-year treaty yet to be made, which will be broken at the halfway point, in other words, 3.5 years through it, at which point the daily sacrifices will be stopped and something called the abomination of desolation will be set up. The final 7 years of the 70 weeks prophecy. So let's pick up there where we left and start reading in Daniel chapter 9 and verse 27. So Daniel chapter 9 is where we actually ended last time, and verse 27, I guess, was the last verse we must have read. So Daniel 9:27, then he, this prince who is to come, shall confirm a covenant, or my margin says treaty, with many for 1 week, one Shabuah, meaning 1 7, which we take to be 7 years. So the prince who is to come shall confirm a treaty with many for 1 7-year period. But in the middle of the seven, at the 3.5-year point, in other words, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. He will stop the sacrifices that are at this point taking place. And on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, the end, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. Bit difficult to make a lot of sense of that last couple of phrases there. I'm going to guess the Hebrew is perhaps not the easiest in the world to translate. But one thing you can see there is it says he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And then you can see a reference to abominations and desolate, as, for example, abomination of desolation. Now, the way it's phrased there, I don't find too helpful. But if you look at, for example, some other translations, and I'll just read one here, the NIV, the nearly inspired version, it translates this verse as, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering, and at the temple he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. So I think we can see that Daniel 9:27 tells us that there'll be a 7-year period. Halfway through it, the sacrifices will be stopped, and the abomination that causes desolation will be set up halfway through it, leaving therefore another 3.5 years to come, you know, after the abomination is erected. Now, we'll see later today, there's another couple of references to this event in Daniel 11 and in Daniel 12, and that will make at least 3 times that Daniel refers to the abomination of desolation. And that's something, of course, that Jesus himself warned us to watch out for. So hold your place there, because we'll be coming back. But look at Matthew 24. Matthew 24 and verses 15 to 22. Matthew 24 is the Olivet prophecy, where Jesus' disciples asked him about when the temple might be destroyed and when he might return. And so we get, if you like, almost the key sign in verse 15. Therefore, says Jesus, when you see, this is something you'll see, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, and then in brackets, the evangelist Matthew has written some helpful words to us, whoever reads, let him understand. So those aren't Jesus' words. Jesus was talking to disciples. He wasn't talking about reading anything. This is Matthew, some years later, writing for your benefit, my benefit. Oh, by the way, when you get to this information about the abomination of desolation and Daniel, make sure you understand it. Which, of course, is what, in a sense, we're trying to do here. So again, verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, and we see that in Daniel 9, 11, and 12, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. You've got to get out of town, get out of Dodge, quickly. Let him who's in the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Let him who's in the field not go back to get his clothes. This is time to urgently flee. Don't dilly-dally. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those with nursing babies in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or in the Sabbath. For then, and when's the then? Well, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, if you understand what you've been reading, then will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be until this time. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. It's cataclysmic. I mean, we can all think of things like, you know, the First World War and the Second World War and the devastation and destruction and the hundreds of millions who died. But that apparently will be as nothing compared to this time, where Jesus says in verse 22, unless those days are cut short, no flesh would be saved. Thankfully, for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. And this great tribulation appears to be triggered by the abomination of desolation. When you see that, if you're in Judea, move urgently. Don't dilly-dally. Don't go back home to pick up your belongings and your treasures. Go, go, go. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Okay, let's go back then to Daniel. So that ends chapter 9. And it brings us to chapters 10, 11, and 12. Now, chapters 10, 11, and 12 are actually all one long, continuous passage. You know, we've divided them, well, not you and me personally, but they have been divided into chapter 10, then there's a break, chapter 11, there's a break, chapter 12, and sometimes we look at them as, you know, self-contained, but they're not. As we'll see, it's actually one long, continuous message. And so chapter 10, if we turn there, introduces the arrival of a powerful angel that God has sent to Daniel with a most interesting and major prophecy for Daniel's attention. So we'll pick up in Daniel 10. Let's read verses 2 and 3. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. So it's sort of like fasting, but not completely, because he was obviously eating and drinking, but it's certainly sort of like a self-denial, what I used to do as a Catholic many decades ago during Lent, when you'd give up something exciting. My mum always gave up cigarette smoking for those days of Lent, and she also used to give up sugar in her cups of tea. So that's what Daniel was doing for 3 sort of full weeks. Let's drop down to verses 10 to 14. So an angel has now arrived, but we're trying to be brief. So here we pick up the story of the angel and Daniel, verses 10 through 14. Suddenly, says Daniel, a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he, the angel, said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved. Which, quite interesting. If an angel comes to you and says, hey, did you know you're greatly loved by God? A bit like, reading the Gospel of John, the disciple whom Jesus loved. It's quite an interesting thought to have. But here we are. Daniel is a man that God greatly loves. O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you. Stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. While he was speaking this word to me, I stood shaking. Then he said to me, do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard. And I've come because of your words. And it seems that 21 days earlier, when Daniel set his heart to understand and to go to God in mourning, that God responded, sent this powerful angel to bring this important message to Daniel 3 weeks ago. Verse 13, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. This being a spirit being that stopped the angel getting through to Daniel for 21 days. In other words, when Daniel started, God gave the answer. And you might have thought, well, surely if God sends his angel, God being God, the angel just will turn up, 2 minutes later in your bedroom with the message, with the answer to your prayer. That's what you and I might think, but this tells us that's not always the case. Verse 13, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me, opposed me, for 21 days. And behold, Michael, we know elsewhere as the archangel, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I'd been left alone there with the kings of Persia. So the angel is battling to get through to Daniel with the message. He's not getting very far. So Michael, the archangel, turns up to provide a bit of extra boost. And finally, the angel gets through. Now I have come to make you understand what will happen, this is a future prophecy, to your people in the latter days. For the vision, which I'm about to explain, refers to many days yet to come. So it's way off in the far distant future, Daniel, as we'll see later. The angel says to Daniel, actually, Daniel, you're gonna die and rest in the grave for a long time until you're resurrected. So this is a long way off in the future, Daniel, not really for your time today. And I guess the fact that this angel is delayed for 21 days by spiritual opposition, wicked spirits in the heavenlies, is just a reminder to us that there is an unseen realm. I guess we tend not to think about it because it's unseen. You don't see demons, and we're probably grateful for that. There are also other types of spirit powers on the dark side, principalities, powers, rulers of this world's wickedness, wicked spirits in heavenly places, and we don't see them. But sometimes if we're looking to God for help, the delay might be because, like in this case, there is spiritual opposition. and it's important we don't give up. God's choosing not to answer. I'll give up now. And the angel who was at your front door at that point says, oops, he stopped believing. She stopped believing. I guess I better turn around and go back to heaven. So, you know, just be mindful of the fact that there is a spirit realm out there. There are powers of darkness. And, you know, you have to be persistent at times. So I guess our summary, if we want, of chapter 10 is simply an angel brings a prophetic message to Daniel as outlined in chapters 11 and 12. Okay, chapter 11 then. Chapter 11 is often referred to as, I think, the longest sort of prophecy or continuous prophecy in the Bible. It is so detailed, apparently, and historically accurate, apparently, that many sort of Bible critics say, hang on, this wasn't written by Daniel way back in 500-something-other BC. It's too detailed, too much information, too accurate. This was clearly written long after Daniel's day. It just pretends to be written by him. Well, that's, of course, the view of the critics, and they're entitled to it. But I think you and I know better than that. But it is a very detailed and accurate picture of about 2,500 years of history from Daniel's day. And essentially, it's 2,500 years of the fighting and opposition between the king of the south and the king of the north. And those battles, and there's lots of them. I'm not going to read through all of Daniel 11. We did that a couple of years back. And to be fair, to me at least, you know, much of the early verses of Daniel 11, I don't really understand the history. I'm not terribly good at ancient history. And this is talking about Egypt and the Ptolemies and the Seleucids and various and sundry other kings and so on. A lot of it is not information I'm very familiar with. But the experts say it's actually pretty accurate. But what it does show us repeatedly is the king of the north, the king of the south, sort of butting heads over and over and over and over again. And guess what? They're going to do it right down to the very, very, very end of time. And that's the story of Daniel 11. Now, the king of the south would appear to be Egypt and its allies. That would be typically Libya and the Sudan, but essentially Egypt. Historically, Egypt was the king of the south. No reason to expect it to be different in the end time, although the gentleman who lives where does Mr. Fleury live?
Edmond,
Oklahoma. Okay, the gentleman who lives in Edmond, Oklahoma seems to think the king of the south is Iran. Tricky, because it never has been historically. And Iran isn't really south, not south of Jerusalem, that's for sure. It's actually, I think, east and north. So the king of the south historically, and I think up to the end time, is Egypt and probably any allies it might have, like Libya and Sudan. King of the north is what's north of Egypt, what's north of Jerusalem, I guess, which will be in the end times, and has been historically, Turkey, Iraq, Syria, Iran, all those Islamic countries. In fact, the king of the south is Islamic today. The king of the north, Turkey, Iraq, Syria, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, is Islamic today. They're all Islamic. Right? That gives us a clue. Now, Daniel 11, we're not going to start at verse 1. It seems to move into modern times, our time, round about verse 21 or thereabouts. It's not totally clear. But let's pick up the story for our purposes at verse 31. So Daniel 11, and we're going to begin in verse 31. And forces or armies shall be mustered by him. That's the king of the north at this point. It swaps king of the north, king of the south, king of the north, king of the south. But here we're talking about the king of the north, which will be the countries from which the prince who is to come, often referred to by, you know, Bible prophecy buffs as the Antichrist, forces shall be mustered by him and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. And they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Now, that's what we read in Daniel 9:27. And this would happen at the halfway point of this final seven-year treaty. So the king of the north shall defile the sanctuary, fortress sanctuary is the holy place, temple, and they shall take away the daily sacrifices, which of course today don't exist. So I guess we're looking for at some point the sacrifices being restored, but it doesn't mean necessarily they'll be restored for very long. You could stop them the day after they start, I suppose. But certainly at some point, the daily sacrifices will start, then they will be stopped, and the king of the north, the Antichrist individual, will place there the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. When you see it, those in Judea, flee. Okay, got that? Carrying on then, verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God, saints, shall be strong and carry out great exploits. Sounds positive. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they, the saints, shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Saints will be harassed somewhat, will they not? Now when they fall, the saints, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purge them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So we do seem to be seeing there that when this abomination of desolation is set up and this king of the north slash antichrist is in full power, that amongst other things that happen, the saints will be harassed and at least a number will be martyred. So it seems to suggest there in verse 35, right up to the time of the end. Right? Of course, Jesus did warn. Okay, let's drop down to verses 40 to 45. Verse 40 through 45. At the time of the end, so remember the angel said to Daniel, these things are for many, many days in the future, at the time of the end. So now we're definitely at the time of the end, I mean, scripturally at least, whether you and I are quite there yet, or whether it's another year or two, or 5 or 10 or 15, regrettably, well, I don't know. If you know, please let me know. But anyway, verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south, Egypt in the main, shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, many ships. He, the king of the north, shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. So more warfare in the Middle East. He shall also enter the glorious land, I guess that's Palestine or the Holy Land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Now, of course, I know that historically we've said, oh, well, that's Jordan. Almost certainly Edom, Moab, Ammon, even today Amman is the capital of Jordan. So Jordan's escaped because, you know, nod, nod, wink, wink, that's where Petra is to be found. And no doubt, you know, the people of God will be hiding in Petra at this stage. And that's why Jordan escapes, because God's protecting those of us hiding away in the caves in Petra. Well, it makes a good story, although, you know, honestly, I suspect it's not going to be that way. I mean, when I first heard about Petra, you know, decades and decades ago, it was still, you know, largely a sort of a unknown, esoteric, you know, secret place. Nobody ever heard of it. Yeah, I mean, our next-door neighbour, nice, literally. The guy next door to us has just come back from Petra about a month ago. So, you know, a lot of people have been there. In fact, you might not know this, but if you go on places like TripAdvisor and, you know, top 10 tourist spots in Jordan, guess what number one is? It's the most popular tourist spot for those that go to Jordan, Petra. And in fact, only in early, well, 3 weeks ago, wasn't it? Early November, mid-November, you might have seen the news that there were some flash floods in Petra. I think 11 or 12 people died in Petra, and 4,000 were evacuated on that one day. 4,000 tourists in Petra at the point where the floods came, and they had to be evacuated for their lives. So you've got to think, well, hang on, that's 4,000 there at one particular point in time in the day. Maybe that was like morning or afternoon, probably 4,000 others at some different time of the day. Maybe that's 8,000 in a day times 7 days in a week. That's like potentially 50,000 visitors a week in Petra. So I don't know. It sounds to me like Petra probably isn't the super-duper secret place. It sounds like a dodgy place. And in fact, of course, I think Mr. Garnet Armstrong years and years and years ago said, you do not want to go to Petra. It's a horrible place. Anyway, but we get to verse 42. He, the king of the north, shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, because king of the south. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, also the Libyans and Ethiopians, but Ethiopia is probably Sudan today, shall follow at his heels, but news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he, the king of the north, shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many, and he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, Mount Zion, of course. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. So, the king of the north will go out creating warfare and destruction and invading all the countries of the south, right up to and including Egypt and Sudan. He will have stopped the sacrifices, erected the abomination of desolation, and in his reign there'll be a lot of martyrs among the saints. So I guess our summary of chapter 11 is the historic and future wars between the king of the north and the king of the south. The historic, we didn't read all those ones, of course, but the historic and future wars between the king of the north and the king of the south. And then it continues into chapter 12. Chapter 12 really isn't a new chapter. Remember, it all begins in chapter 10, it goes straight through 11, straight through 12. You know, very often when you're doing your chapter a day, you know, you read one chapter and stop, come back a day later or two or three days later, pick up where you left off. Well, you know, maybe. If you do that, you miss the point, because there is no gap here. The angel is still busy, you know, talking away to Daniel. So Daniel 12 is unbroken, just continues 11. At that time, at what time? Well, at the time of the end, when the king of the north goes invading all the countries of the south. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and at this time, there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. Now, where did we read that, 10 minutes ago? Jesus talked about great tribulation, such as has never been on the earth till that time, no, nor never shall be, and except those days are cut short, no flesh would be saved. So same time, right? So we can see here that the angels discussing with Daniel the great tribulation at the end time, and the great tribulation begins after the abomination of desolation. Jesus said so, right? So that helps us to put these into a sort of timeline. It helps us a little bit. Still a huge amount, we don't know, of course, but you can sort of get the outline, if nothing else. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. So this is sort of one fairly good clue that it's the end time, because it's talking of the resurrection. right? At this time, when Michael stands up in a time of trouble unequaled in man's history, it says, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. They'll come back to life. They'll be resurrected. Some to everlasting life. I assume there must be a gap then before we come to some to shame and everlasting contempt, because that sounds like the very, very end after the millennium. But we're talking about, clearly, end time events, right? This isn't something that happened way back in Daniel's day or the days of Alexander the Great or whatever. This is definitely, definitely end time. Let's look at Daniel 12 and look at verses 4 and 9 together. Verse 4, but you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Verse 9, and the angel said, go your way, Daniel. Nothing to do with you, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. So actually, Daniel is told to seal up the words because they won't be understandable. The meaning, the interpretation will not become evident until we reach the time of the end. Right? So what we can tell from that is there really any previous explanations, much before today, of what Daniel means are highly unlikely to be that accurate. I mean, in places I'm sure they will be, but the overall story cannot have been understood up till about now, because the angel says twice, seal it up, Daniel, until the time of the end. I mean, for example, Sir Isaac Newton, tells us why an apple falls down from the tree and all that stuff. But Isaac Newton, he wrote a commentary on the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation, apart from doing mathematics and calculus and biology and botany and all the rest of it. He's also quite a Bible scholar, and he wrote, a lengthy book, maybe 300 pages worth of commentary on Daniel and Revelation, published way back in the 1700s. Well, I'm sure it was a monumental achievement for the man to do that. But guess what? It can't have been accurate because it was sealed to the time of the end. And 1700 isn't the time of the end. That's over 300 years ago. Or take Adam Clarke. He's one of the best commentaries, very conservative commentary. And he's got all manner of explanations of Daniel 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6. Mr. Clark, sorry, it was sealed up till the time of the end. Or what about the Seventh-day Adventists and their explanations of what Daniel and the beasts represent? Well, Seventh-day Adventists came to their understanding the days really of Ellen G. White, which was, the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. I'm sorry, but the Seventh-day Adventist view, Ellen G. White's view, they could have tried their best and been honest and sincere, but it wasn't the time of the end, guys. Or you might say the Worldwide Church of God, becoming closer to home. There are books out there, articles galore, written by various and sundry ministers and evangelists and so on about Daniel and Revelation. Well, as far as Daniel's concerned, if it was written in the 1950s, 40s, 60s, 70s, sorry, as far as I'm concerned, that's not the time of the end. That was 50, 60, 70 years ago, century ago. But you and I, hopefully, can come to understand these things. Okay, with that in mind, let's go back and read verses 5 through 9. So Daniel 12 and verses 5 through 9. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two other angels, I guess, one on this riverbank, the other on that riverbank. These are the tails of the riverbank. And one said to the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? How long is it going to take? And the one said to the man clothed in linen, who was above, and I've just read that, verse 7, then I heard the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven, and swore by him who lives forever that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished or consumed, terminated. In other words, it will be for time, times, and half a time. Verse 8, although I heard, says Daniel, I did not understand, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? Tell me again. He said, go your way, Daniel. Move on, Daniel. Move on, Daniel. Nothing to say here. For the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end, so they're really not for you to know what it means. But notice there in verse 7, how long will it be till it's all fulfilled? Time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been totally shattered, it will all be done. Right, well, what's time, times, and half a time? Well, I think most Bible scholars say that's 3.5 years. A time is 1 year, times is another two, and half, obviously, is a half, so it's 3.5 times, 3.5 years. Right? And of course, that would tie in with the 7-year covenant or 7-year treaty that we saw in Daniel 9:27, which is broken at the halfway point, leaving there for 3.5 years to come, time, times, and half a time, right? And hold your place there. Look at Daniel 7. Let's read verses 25 to 27. So with that, time, times, and half a time, let's look at Daniel 7. Just read verses 25 to 27. Daniel 7:25, he, talking of the final king of the north, Antichrist, Chappie, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute or harass the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law, perhaps into Sharia law, then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. Well, that would appear to be the same as the angel talking about in Daniel 12. Remember, the power of the holy people shall be completely shattered and destroyed and consumed. And here it says that the saints shall be given into the hand of this end-time Antichrist for time, times and half a time, 3.5 years. But the court shall be seated, they shall take away his dominion, consume and destroy forever, and then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. It's, in other words, right at the end time, when the resurrection of the saints and the change of those alive takes place. Okay, let's go back then to Daniel 12. We just read verses 5 through 9. Let's pick up in verses 11 through 13. And from the time, remember the angel asked, when shall all this happen? From the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. So this is the third time today that we've seen daily sacrifices stopped, abomination of desolation set up. Right? That's three places, Daniel 9, Daniel 11, Daniel 12. And Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, get out of there. For then there'll be great tribulation. Okay, hopefully it all sort of comes together, at least in broad outline. So from that particular time, there'll be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. But you, Daniel, forget it. You go your way till the end, for you shall rest. You're going to die. And you will arise in the resurrection to your inheritance at the end of the days of this prophecy. So the prophecy goes right up to the very end, to the resurrection of the saints, like Daniel. And so hopefully we can see here there's quite a lot of dating going on. It looks like We'll be able to even count down the days, right? When we see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, that will demonstrate there are times and half a time to go, or as it says here, 1290 days, or 1335 days, similar times. I mean, I've seen all sorts of explanations as to what happens between 1335 and 1290. Well, this is what's going to happen. Well, very speculative. The point is that when we get closer to these days, it will become much clearer, all right?
We hope.
At the moment, we can see that 7 years, halfway point, covenant broken, and then 3.5 years, or times and half a time, or 1290 days, or 1335 days, all very similar periods, during which the saints seem to have a very rough time. Okay, so the summary of chapter 12, I guess, is that Daniel 12 concludes the lengthy prophecy starting in Daniel 10. The prophecy is sealed till the time of the end, but gives us a countdown from the abomination of desolation till Jesus returns. And there's a good chance that many of the events in Daniel will take place, you know, very shortly, because the Middle East is in the news almost every day, especially Iran, increasingly Turkey, and Saudi Arabia is not far behind. And as we saw a couple of years back, Saudi Arabia is probably the great whore, great harlot of Revelation 17. So as I've said before, you know, I need to watch the events in the Middle East. And with that in mind, we've now concluded, I think, Daniel 1 to 12, briefly for the time being. But since I've said watch, here's an illustration of what we could watch out for. Because the next event in prophecy appears to be that Iran is going to launch an attack across the Middle East. Daniel 8 says the Ram, which is Persia or Iran, launches an attack north and south and west, and nobody can stop it for a while. And you know, I might think, well, you know, Iran's a long way off. It's quite a long way from Britain, a long way from Austria. And if you're in the US of A, it's like, far part of the world, who cares? But actually, if Daniel 8 says what we think it says, then there's major problems coming our way. Now, Iran is going to, by the sound of it, launch this attack across much of the Middle East. It's probably going to be, to a large extent, religious. Although Iran is Islamic, it is a Shia version of Islam, whereas most Muslims are actually Sunni. So for the remaining sort of 10 minutes I've got today, I just want a quick roundup of some of the newsworthy items relating to Iran in particular, because that's, I think, the next big thing we will see, Iran on the warpath. You know, people have been concerned about Iran for decades, people in the Western world. And the sanctions were in place on Iran for decades to try and, you know, curtail what it could do. But those sanctions, which I think worked pretty well, were lifted about 2 years ago, early 2016, Mr. Obama. You might remember him, the suspect Muslim himself. But Mr. Obama lifted these sanctions, and the numbers differ, but somewhere between $50 billion and $150 billion came back into Iranian coffers. And Mr. Obama did actually send an aircraft with cash notes of $1.7 billion to the Iranians because of some sort of promise that they might postpone for a few years their nuclear ambitions. So you might remember that. And in those 2 years, things haven't worked out very well. The Iranian defense budget, what they spend on military, has jumped up by 145%. Well, extra money now. They've had a massive military restructuring, and they've now got a military that they believe is a, quotes, forward-moving force. forward moving force. That would be like leaving Iran, wouldn't it? Moving elsewhere. They've continued to directly, openly, and covertly support terrorism and hostile forces across much of the Middle East, Iraq, Syria. I mean, they're great supporters of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. They're fighting in the Yemen. So they've used that money to basically magnify, amplify their activities across much of the Middle East. They're not interested in just Iran itself. They've got much bigger vision for Iranian power. Even today, Iran is the 20th most powerful military country on the earth. Right? Not nowhere in comparison to the USA or China, but pretty big. Turkey is number 8, by the way. And of course, you'll be aware, in the last few months, Mr. Donald Trump, who has a different view of Iran, has restored sanctions. You know, there was a lot of stuff in the paper in the last couple of weeks or so, playing on Game of Thrones, which is, against the TV, well-known TV sort of program, because he's got himself shown there with, was it, sort of, sanctions are coming, using the Game of Thrones font. I think in their story, it's, winter is coming. Mr. Trump doesn't mess about, it seems. So he's restored sanctions, and they're biting, and they're painful. Big impact. So the question would be, what will Iran do next? Well, of course, I don't suppose anybody knows. But one of the most obvious repercussions of a Mideast war, and the Bible tells us Iran will launch one, would be the impact on oil. Because the Persian Gulf, where Iran is, supplies about 25% of all the world's oil. You disrupt the oil, and you get economic chaos everywhere. Everywhere. The bodies might be dying through missile attacks and armies in Iraq and Syria and eastern Turkey and Saudi Arabia. But economically, no matter where you are, you will be impacted. The countries most impacted by oil interruptions would be Japan, South Korea, Taiwan. They've got no oil to speak of. big problems on day one. And actually, the next country is Turkey. So if Iran stops the oil, Turkey will hurt very quickly, which is why we'll probably end up launching a counterattack pretty quickly. Other countries like the USA, here in the United Kingdom, countries like Mexico, Canada, Russia, much less of a problem. But on the other hand, oil prices would shoot up. You know, back in 1973, if you were alive then, there was an oil embargo after an Arab-Israeli sort of war. There was a 6% reduction in supply, 6%, and oil prices doubled. We're talking here about 25%. Reduction. What will oil prices do in those countries that can still acquire oil? So here's some three references in the last 4 weeks, right? Just saying, watch Iran, watch what they're up to, watch their attitude, watch for this war to be launched at some point. For example, of the three, the first one was some guy called the Ayatollah Alamoloda, Alamo for short. Ayatollah Alamo, he's in the Assembly of Experts, which is a particular body in Iran that chooses the new supreme leader, and he says, quote, "If Iran decides, a single drop of this region's oil will not be exported." By region, he means the entire Persian Gulf. If Iran decides, not one drop. That could just be cheap talk, of course, but that's what he's thinking. He says, quotes, "Iran has the power to instantly drive up the price of oil to $400 a barrel." Now, yesterday it was $58 a barrel. That's like, ooh, that'll make your eyes water. He suggests that Iran can seize oil tankers from other countries sailing through their waters. And he's suggested that some other Gulf countries like the United Arab Emirates, and even Saudi Arabia would be destroyed in 60 minutes. Well, I think that sounds like you know, bravado, talk, rhetoric, but gives you a clue, doesn't it? The Iranians know they can cause mayhem because of what they can do to oil supplies. And that was one. Let's take Reuters. So that was middle of November that was reported. Reuters, an article from the 21st of November, just about 10 days ago. The headline was, Iran says U.S. bases and aircraft carriers are within their missile range. So IRGC, which is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, a commander said, quotes, U.S. bases in Afghanistan, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and U.S. aircraft carriers in the Gulf are within our missile range. So they're thinking that, you know, America, sanctions, we might retaliate. Again, that, you know, easy talk for these guys, potentially a lot of bravado. But then again, we know what Daniel 8 says, don't we? Daniel 8 says it's going to happen, whether it's apparently bravado or not. Or the third reference from the month of November is from the Jewish newspaper Haaretz, 2nd of November, so about a month ago. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had been at a conference, and the conference was talking about how the Saudi Arabians had killed and dismembered Mr. Khashoggi. A journalist, you've probably all been following the interesting events there. And of course, Saudi Arabia has rather blotted its copybook in the eyes of much of the world as a result of that. But anyway, having been discussing that at the seminar, the conference, Netanyahu says, quotes, the largest problem is Iran. You know, okay, discuss Saudi Arabia and Khashoggi and, you know, killing and dismembering people and all that sort of stuff. But quotes, the largest problem is Iran. And we, he says, I guess the Israelis, have helped to uncover two terrorist attacks, one in Paris, one in Copenhagen, organized by the Iranian Secret Service. He continues, blocking Iran is uttermost on our agenda for security, not merely for Israel, but I believe for Europe and the world as well. So Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu says, okay, Saudi's got his problems and Turkey's got his problems and we Jews have got problems with the Arab world. But I'll tell you what he says, Iran is the number one risk to us, to the Europeans and to the world. Now, okay, maybe Mr. Netanyahu's exaggerating to make a point. Maybe he's playing politics on the big world. But you and I know something he doesn't, probably. We know that Daniel 8 tells us that Iran will actually do what people fear. It will launch an attack across much of the Middle East. It will decimate oil supplies from the Persian Gulf. It will cause mayhem in the Middle East and probably major problems for those of you in Peoria, downtown San Antonio, you know, Belfast, Vienna, Birmingham, San Francisco will all be affected to one extent or another. And you might ask the question, well, how could Iran get away with this? I mean, why would the USA, for example, not stop them? And of course, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't suppose anybody does. All we know is that Daniel 8 tells us that the ram will rush out to the west, the north and the south, and nobody will stop him. So the USA will not stop it. Now, why not? I don't know. Speculate. The USA may have its own problems. Perhaps they've got a new president by this time who doesn't want to go fighting in foreign countries. Perhaps they've got the current president. Perhaps he's fighting off impeachment. Perhaps there's other local problems in the USA that mean, you know, their eyes and minds are preoccupied elsewhere. The eyes off the ball. Who knows? All we can say is, irrespective of how we can logically, rationally think about the scenario, the Bible is our guidebook, and the Bible tells us in Daniel 8, as part of the end time prophecies, and Daniel 8 specifically says, end time, latter days, that the ram will launch an attack to the north, to the south, and to the west. And nobody will stop it for a while, until eventually the goat, the he-goat, which we believe represents Javan or modern-day Turkey, will of course launch its counterattack, and then they'll pulverize, Iran to pieces. So, I guess with that, we've pretty much concluded now our look through the book of Daniel. Again, there's more material a couple of years back if you want to go into any of those chapters in more detail. And what I've just read to you there is just the last 4 weeks' information about Iran. Watch Iran. That's probably the next big event you and I are going to see. And when that starts, that's the dominoes starting to fall, and the end time is upon us. Okay, with that, we'll conclude today's Bible study.